Hello, everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where one writer talks to another writer about the books we write and the lives we lead and how these two are one and the same. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with the best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org, and we are funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. To learn more about the PNWA, as well as their fabulous yearly writers conference, please go to pnwa.org. Well, you know, when I was a young man, poetry played a significant role in my life. It was one of those sort of life preservers I turned to when things got stormy, as they often did at that time in my life. And for me, my relationship to it was very real, and as real as sort of my relationship to, say, things like pop songs and movies and novels. And so it's always a pleasure when I get to have guests like today's guest, Elizabeth Austin, on the show, because as well as being a poet herself and a teacher, she's also something of an ambassador for poetry, not only in appearing on Seattle's public radio station KUOW, where she's a regular contributor, but also by bringing poetry out to a lot of people maybe who didn't think that they needed it, like her job at Children's Hospital in Seattle, and just finding ways to get to sort of everyday folks who don't look upon poetry as an everyday part of their life. And I say more power to her, and let's get her on the show. Elizabeth, welcome to Author to Author.
Thanks, Bill. Glad to be here.
Well, it's my pleasure. Let's first of all let those folks who maybe haven't read your work find out how to get to it. Your collection of poetry, your first full-length collection of poetry, was released in 2011, and it was Every Dress a Decision. Is that right?
That's right. Published by Blue Begonia Press.
Well, congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
And now, and also, if they're in the Seattle area, of course, they could probably do it online, too. As I mentioned, you're a regular contributor to KUOW. What exactly do you do, and how can they find you there?
Well, I do a couple of things for KUOW, but the thing I do most often is I bring poets into the studio and record them reading their own poems, and then I will broadcast those poems one at a time, and I'll do a little introduction to the poem that's really aimed at providing kind of a frame or a doorway so the unsuspecting listener who doesn't know a poem is coming their way has a way to sort of step into the poem.
Right.
And then those are also posted online. And then I also do author interviews from time to time. But you can go to kuow.org, and if you do a keyword search on poetry, you'll pull up a whole list of poetry-related interviews and poems.
Right. And so you frame it to say, don't panic. It's just a poem. You don't have to worry. And I think that's great because, you know, well, actually, before I get to that, and so you also, you have an unusual day job. You work at Children's Hospital, and what is it you do there?
Yeah, I'm really lucky. I work 3 days a week at the hospital and one day a week at KUOW, which is a really sane schedule for a writer. And so what they mostly pay me for at the hospital is to do something called content strategy, which has to do with getting material up on the web that will work for the needs of its intended audience. But for the last 5 or 6 years, I've also worked with the pastoral care program at the hospital. There's a donor who has the insight to understand that if healthcare people burn out, they can't provide good care and they eventually drop out of the profession.
Right.
And so there is some funding there to provide programs for the staff that will help nourish and sustain them. And so, for example, I meet once a month for an hour with the folks who provide palliative care, which is basically comfort care for kids with terminal illness. So an incredibly stressful, demanding, emotional job, and that's a group of about 7 people that I meet with for an hour once a month, and we read poems together, and I suggest writing prompts, and we do reflective writing and write poetry together.
That is fantastic. You know, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, and then I also offer a monthly open session that any staff member can come to. And I bring in a few poems and read them aloud, because adults don't get read aloud to often enough.
No.
And then we do a little 10-minute free writing session together. I provide a few prompts for that. It's just a half an hour, so people, you know, can use their part of their lunch hour. And I get folks from all over the hospital. I even have a couple of doctors who come as often as they can. Nurses, social workers, physical therapists.
That's great. You know, I mentioned this very quote last week, but it's so pertinent to this that I'm going to mention it again. Viktor Frankl, who wrote Man's Search for Meaning, described despair is suffering without meaning.
Thank you for reminding me of that.
Right?
And
so this is great work you do with those poor, not poor, they're choosing to do that work, but it's challenging work. And for sure, even if you're a professional, a doctor dealing with children dying, if ever suffering can seem meaningless, it would certainly be then, I would think. And if poetry can do nothing else, it can remind us that meaning does not exist, is not based upon how many years we get to spend on the planet. It's not a game you win.
Absolutely.
In the moment. So that is, it's great work. It's great work.
You know, it's incredibly satisfying for me to get to do it, because I couldn't do what those folks do. For 100 reasons I couldn't do it.
Right.
But if I'm able to support them or encourage them, then I am in some way helping with what they're doing. And that gives a lot of meaning for my work. But the other thing that it's demonstrating to me time and time again is how much the process of translating our own perceptions and emotions into language, that process itself is healing. That it,
absolutely.
It helps give perspective. It helps us just feel a sense of integrating that experience in a way that too many of us are taught that you have to be a specialist to be able to do that. And I have started to think of myself really kind of as a poetry evangelist.
Yeah.
That I think that a lot of people have been told that they're not smart enough or creative enough or whatever enough for poetry. And I think poetry is part of our human birthright.
Absolutely. And I
want to help people have access to it.
Yes, because language is the tool, obviously, of the poet. But to me, the job of the poet is not simply to be a language mechanic or a language carpenter. The job of the poet, which is the job of the artist and the teacher or the preacher, is perspective. And you're using language to take a perspective, to frame an experience so that it is meaningful and not meaningless. You can look upon death as meaningless or meaningful. You can look upon divorce as meaningless or meaningful. And all depends on, it's the same experience. You know, you could have two parents who both lose the same child. One uses that experience to transform her life, the other to end his life. And it's the same child, same family, same house, different experience. And it's all perspective.
Yep, I agree. And I think part of the way poetry helps us do that is that the very act of comprehending a metaphor, the idea that one thing is itself and it's also borrowing the qualities of another thing, and that isn't a math equation, that increases our capacity to tolerate ambiguity, that two things can be true simultaneously.
Yeah.
And I think that we need to cultivate that ability more than ever as our world becomes more complex, moves faster, and frankly also as, you know, we've seen quite a rise in various forms of fundamentalism, which I think is kind of a reaction to the stress of many things being true at once, or comes from a desire for there to be one truth. And poetry really gives us a chance in a finite amount of time and space to tolerate ambiguity and maybe even to find it pleasurable.
Well, you as a writer, everyone is creative. Every human being on earth is creative. There's no way around it. But as a writer, one of the things writing taught me, and I thought of this when I read the title of your collection, is writing taught me the power of free choice, and that whether I like it or not, I can join a religion that's the most fundamentalist religion in the world, and I would still have to choose to do that. And you know, you've got that blank page. and you're the only one who can fill it, and you are picking every damn word, and you have to pick
right.
them all.
Right. Yeah, I mean, those, making art is all about selection and choosing.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And you also do work where you're trying to bring poetry out to people who don't think of themselves as poets or have a kind of, a distant relationship to it. Describe what you're doing there.
Yeah, so this actually came about almost by accident. Some folks that I had worked with here at the hospital said that they wanted friends of theirs outside the hospital to have access to what I was doing. And so a whole series of these one-day workshops popped up where somebody would host at their home, me and maybe 10 or 12 other people, and we'd spend the day together. I'd bring in poems for us to talk about, to read together and talk about, and basically just respond to. And then some various writing activities, things that would, for example, involve people going out into the world and noticing what object called to them, and then we'd bring it back to the group, and we'd practice describing it, and then we'd practice looking at what that object might have to tell us about ourselves through some various things, writing exercises to do with metaphor, and then before people knew it, they were writing poems. What I have found is that it whether or not people leave that day deciding to become poets isn't relevant to me. It's whether or not they've reconnected with their own creative capacity and their own ability to see deeply into the world around them and to value what they see and how they see it.
Great. Great. Because the world is always a better place when one person recognizes that their life is a creative act and that the choices and the decisions they make matter, that's what their
mm-hmm.
life is. Which is one of the great gifts of the artistic life, is you recognize this. You may complain about it, no one's listening to me, I'm not publishing, but you do recognize that it's a creative act, what you're doing.
Yeah, yeah.
That's awesome. You know, I was reading a poem of yours, it was called Untitled, and funny, at first I thought, well, that's lazy, she should have titled it, and then I read the poem, and I thought, oh, that's a clever title, I see. And without giving the poem away, it involves shame, in this case sort of female sexual shame, but shame in general. And it seems to me, and maybe you could talk about this, that one of the challenges, at least it was for me, that artists go through to go and be willing to share their work out in the world with strangers is dealing with the concept of shame, because there is a kind of nakedness that one must sort of contend with when showing this work that you've written in private and then handing over with no control sort of to strangers ultimately.
Yeah, you know, I'm very interested in the whole idea of what does it mean to be female in our culture right now. And so that poem Untitled is partly me thinking about why is it that I can, without any problem at all, say, refer to my nose or my elbow or my eye, but my vagina, I can't even hardly say it
right.
to you in this,
well,
right? And your whole audience probably just jumped.
Yeah. Exactly.
Why is that? And specifically the poem is thinking about, you know, what are we teaching little girls when we will say this is your eye, this is your nose, and that's your ha-ha, or whatever word whatever metaphor you use. And so to answer your larger question about the writing process, there's a wonderful couple of TED Talks by a researcher named Brené Brown, and she's talking about shame and about vulnerability. And I think the key to living a courageous life as an artist is to be willing to be vulnerable. And for me, what that means is being willing to go as far as I can with my own self-inquiry about whatever it is that I'm writing about, to be as true to my perspective and to bring as much craft as I possess at that moment to bear on conveying and exploring that perspective. But then at some point, I'm going to bring that back to the people around me, aware that They may disagree with it. They may not like it. It might upset them. It might bore them. And so all of that, to do that is to be vulnerable. But without risking that vulnerability, nothing true gets made. Nothing profound gets made. What Brené Brown is getting to in her research is that vulnerability is also the way we connect truly with other people.
Yeah.
And I have certainly found that to be true in my own life as a writer and a teacher and a performer. That's the key.
Absolutely. My brother does a lot of acting still, and he said, I remember when we were young and doing acting together, he said to me, and he had done more at that point than I had, he said, remember, your job is never to be embarrassed. You can't be embarrassed up there. That's one of the gifts you give the audience, is your embarrassment about your whatever the character's doing, no matter how embarrassing their behavior, you're not embarrassed by it as a person, as an actual person, not just an actor.
Yeah.
You know, I think about, I said this a couple of weeks ago when I was talking to Laura Munson on the show, but it's a great quote from a book called Course in Miracles, where it says that in my defenselessness, my safety lies. And I think that's absolutely true. And it's not always easy to live by, but I think that when you can, and for sure as a performer and as a writer, that you have to understand there's nothing to protect. It feels like there is, but I think that shame is in a sense waiting for a wound, anticipating a wound that is never delivered, but waiting for it to happen.
Yeah.
Does that make
sense? It does, and I also think it's also rooted in these completely unreal expectations we set for ourselves that we need to somehow be perfect.
Yes.
And I think the truth is we just have to be present.
Yes.
One of the things I love to teach, because I was an actor before I was a writer, is performance, particularly because so many poets really struggle with and really suffer with it.
Thank you. You're doing a great service, Elizabeth. Okay, go ahead.
But the main point I try to make when I teach this is a fundamental concept that your role is to show up and let the poems move through you into the room.
Yes.
So that a listener might connect with someone that's necessary for their life. And so I have this mantra that I use myself. I reminded myself before I started this conversation with you. The performance requires me, but it's not about me. The performance requires me, but it's not about me.
I love it.
Because I have to show up. If I didn't call in, you wouldn't have an interview guest. But I'm not the point. What you and I create together will hopefully be of use to someone. But I'm just responsible for showing up. And the same is absolutely true when I perform a poem, whether it's mine or someone else's. I'm the vehicle for it getting into the room. But it's up to the audience, to the listener, to attend to that poem or not, to connect with it or not. I'm only responsible for the 50% of it, which is getting it out into the room.
Whoa.
And that frees me tremendously.
Well, you are preaching to the choir here. You know, I know that one of the people I love to listen to read poetry is Garrison Keillor, who, you know, does it. And I think he's great. I mean, he's got a wonderful voice. He's got a good instrument. But he, I think, does a great job of just letting himself become the vessel for it to pass through that voice of his. And he gets out of the way. But he brings feeling to it. But it's not about Garrison Keillor loving poetry or showing you that he loves poetry. He just delivers it. I heard once, this was really disappointing, I heard Dylan Thomas reading Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night. And it was, for me, difficult to listen to because he so dramatized it. And I felt like, man, you don't have to do nothing to that poem. Just let it go. That thing is just sings all by itself. But he, the rendition I heard, he was bringing all this to it, you know, and it was so unnecessary. So unnecessary.
Well, partly it's the style of the age that he was working
probably.
In. I mean, if you, you know, watch movies from that time or, you know, were to hear a recording of a stage performance, there's a different, you know, there's a different level of verisimilitude that we expect. But I agree with you that if he had simply been, but here's the other thing. Dylan Thomas is also wearing a mask when he performs like that. He's he's less vulnerable performing that way.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. Actually, I was thinking, it was funny. I was thinking about listening. I was listening to some old pre Stanislavski method actors doing Shakespeare, and it was dramatic. Then to hear a modern day, you listen to like just who is Elizabeth Taylor's husband? You know, Richard Burton. Listen to him do Hamlet, and then listen to somebody from the 20s or 30s. It was almost
very
different. Oh, totally different. It's what I've become used to for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So, Elizabeth, when you write a poem, where do you begin normally? Does it begin with like an idea, or does it begin with a character, a sound, an image? Where does it usually start for you?
You know, it starts a lot of different places for me, and sometimes it starts with something that I've read of someone else's that gets me thinking about something. And so a lot of my poems begin with epigraphs, you know, a little quote from another poet.
Yeah.
And I'm responding to that. Often poems will come from me trying to understand something. My whole book, Every Dress a Decision, has at its core me wrestling with the sudden death of my older brother, Michael. And many, many of those poems simply began with me thinking about some aspect of that loss and trying to write my way toward a deeper level of understanding than when I began writing. And it's one of the things that I'm tremendously grateful for about being a writer is that I have a place to put those questions, those dilemmas. And then the struggle for me is always to try to apply as much craft as I can to push the process of the poem deeper. It's one of the things that I didn't really understand as a young writer was that craft and content weren't separate. That the more I attended to the poem as a poem, meaning dealing with line breaks and the form and music and sound and metaphor and how the poem was developing, the more that would push my own sense of understanding of whatever it was that I was trying to write in response to further.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's a really good point. And it's hard sometimes for people who don't write to believe, but I know it's true for me. I write a daily column for the magazine for Author. And though no one believes me, I look upon them as poems, even though they're 400 word essays. I treat them like a poem because I don't provide an answer. I aim for an emotional endpoint that will direct you to the answer to the sort of problem I sort of posed at the beginning of it. But why it reminded me of what you just said was that I often begin with something that happened to me. You know, of course, it's every day, so I got to mine, you know, any little event.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't matter. What's cool is you can find so much material in anything. And I often begin knowing that was an interesting moment. I wonder why it was interesting and why is it meaningful? And I don't know
exactly
until I get to the end. But in the writing it, I learn. I learn in the writing.
Exactly.
I really do.
Yeah, I also keep a notebook. Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, I'm done.
I was just going to say, I also keep a notebook and just write down things that I notice for that very reason that you just said, which is often I'll go back to that and say, well, of all the things I saw that afternoon, why is that what I wrote down? Why was that? What is it about that that was speaking to my subconscious? I took a wonderful class with the poet Linda Beards a few years ago at Richard Hugo House, and she was talking about the importance of trusting your subconscious.
Yes.
That when it notices things, when it hangs on to things, when they come up in a free write, to use them as invitations to go into territory that you haven't gone into before, that there's something asking for your attention.
Yes, absolutely. That's one of the things I've learned to trust with myself, both in writing the daily column, and I've just finished a memoir where I knew I was writing about a subject, but I would ask my imagination for what scenes I should pick out, and it would give me something, and I'd think, yes, that was interesting, but why? How is it relevant? And I don't know, but it gives it to me very strongly, and I have to trust that now my job, I mean, there was this one scene with my son where he told me crackers weren't treats, and it was significant. I remember at the time it happened, I thought, now I know that the diagnosis of autism is incorrect. I remember thinking that at that moment. But I didn't know why. I couldn't put it into words, and it took me 7 drafts of that story for it to become clear to me. But I knew it was there because I thought it as soon as it happened. But I had to write it to learn why, and I'm glad I did.
Yeah. Well, and this is why I want to teach people about writing. Because if more people had that skill and that sense of trust that they could come to find an answer if they spent the time with themselves inquiring, I think that would be transformative and enormously healing for people.
Oh, it's enormous. I know it's healing for me, but you have to be willing to be quiet. You have to
be
quiet and listen, because you don't know what the answer is. You've got to hear it. And
you've got to be willing to tolerate the not knowing.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do. You have to sit for a time in not knowing and let the answer come to you. And a lot of people think they have to know it. But I do it often enough now that I've learned to trust that not knowing and trust it with that. If I'm truly quiet and truly empty, that's the space that the answer will eventually fill. But I got to wait.
Right. Yeah.
You know? All right. Well, listen, we have just a couple minutes left, and I want to get one more question or one more answer from you. And I think you are particularly well equipped to answer this. Finish this sentence for me. If writing has taught me anything, it has taught me what?
To trust my own darkness.
To trust your own darkness. All right. You have to elaborate on that one for me. Why do you have to trust darkness and not your light?
Well, it's not an either-or thing, but I am someone who for most of my life has tried to pretend that I'm all light, which of course isn't true because I'm human.
Yeah.
But where poetry really cracked open for me was when I started, at the urging of a couple of really marvelous teachers like Marie Howe and Frank Gaspar, to ask myself, what else is also true? And I end every reflective writing session with the folks that I work with, the last minute or so, I'll call out into the room, ask yourself, what else is also true? And you can feel the whole room lean in and intensify for that last minute or two. But often that's where the part comes up that is a little bit messier. I grew up a rules follower. And so it's been very, very helpful for me to trust that part of me that is rebellious and chaotic and contrary and dark, and that the more I welcome that and trust it and don't try to push it away or pretend it's not there, the richer my work becomes.
Right. That is excellent. Okay, everybody, trust your darkness. Listen to Elizabeth. I think she's right. Well, Elizabeth, thank you so much. This has been absolutely wonderful, as I knew it would be.
It was a huge pleasure for me. Thank you for your wonderful questions.
Oh, you're very welcome. Okay, everyone. Well, there you go. Trust your darkness. I just love it. I love doing the show. And, I started Author Magazine, and I did my interviews, and I do the show because I know that when you write, you can feel alone. You can feel like you're on your own and you've got no one, and what you're doing is absolutely only your challenge, but it's not. It's not true. And it's also why I've just published a collection of essays, of short inspirational essays and stories called Write Within Yourself, an Author's Companion, because it's just that. It was my attempt to create for you a companion of a kind for your bedside table or your pocketbook or wherever you need it, to remember that you're not alone. We're all in this together. So pick it up if you want, Write Within Yourself, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever they sell books. And until next week when I'll be talking to Fred Waitzkin, do what you love, trust your darkness, and just be happy. You really can't go wrong.